Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Ben Lam, the CEO of Colossal.
Hey, Ben, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So Ben, I haven't had the chance to speak with you one-on-one since I had my advisor onboarding all the way back in 2023. And for all our listeners here today, I've been proudly supporting and advising the amazing work Colossal are doing. And I'm so excited to be able to talk with you here today and share with everyone the journey that has been Colossal. I would love for you to tell our listeners a bit about yourself. How did you first become interested in de-extinction and genetic technologies? And what brought together Colossal?
Yeah, so I mean, I wish I could say that this was my brilliant idea, but it's really the brainchild of George Church, my co-founder. And if you don't know George, George is arguably the father of synthetic biology. He's the head of genetics at Harvard. He's one of the most prolific people in the entire world when it comes to reading and writing genomes, DNA synthesis, and a lot of developmental biology. So he's many world's firsts have come out of George's lab. And, you know, my background is really in building teams of much smarter women and men than me. And I've been in everything from satellite software and space hardware to gaming to conversational intelligence before we called it large language models. So I've been in a lot of different categories and but all around technology and kind of centric around like what is the next kind of opportunity. And I'm very, very passionate about climate change. I'm very, very passionate about doing things that have a big impact. So I reached out to George. I actually just cold called George because I thought that my last company was going pretty well. And I was thinking like if we could actually engineer life in this whole concept of synthetic biology and seeing that the rise of access to compute, the rise of AI and the ability to build software systems that I think that we could actually help engineer and design life or at least do directed evolution in a way where we could potentially make positive impacts to the planet was really interesting to me. So I called George. I asked him if there was an opportunity in this in synthetic biology. He answered my questions in like 6 minutes. And then I had like 3-4 minutes left with George, right? And so I didn't want to waste them. And I'm pretty curious. So I asked him, I was like, George, what else you got? What else are you working on? What's interesting? And he walked me through a bunch of different problems that he's working on, lots of different projects. And I said, George, this is all amazing. If you had one project with unlimited capital, what would you do? You've changed the world many times. What would you do if you do one thing? And he said, just without skipping a beat, in his voice, there's an inflection in his voice that changed and everything. He said, I would use the technologies that I and others have created to bring back mammoths, reintroduce them into the Arctic to help the ecosystem. I'd use those technologies to bring back other species. I'd use the same technologies to save endangered species and advance human healthcare. And I'm dumb enough that I asked this at the end of the call. And so then the call was like over. And I stayed up all night and I was like insanely focused on, you know, reading clips about George and watching videos. And no matter what I watched, there was this through line, whether he was on 60 Minutes or the Colbert Report or in some podcast or in Time, he would always talk about the mammoth. And you could even hear it when he talked about that, this inflection change. So at that moment, as an entrepreneur that said 1,000 times, I want to do something that has a meaningful impact to the world, not just things that make money, but how can we do something that like truly leaves a lasting change and inspires people? And, you know, I felt like I would be the biggest hypocrite ever if George Church put this on my plate and then I didn't go pursue it. So a week later, I was in his lab. And then 2 days after that, I was starting to work on the deal docs with him and trying to figure out how do I bring in a new CEO to replace me at the current company I was running so that I could go pursue this full time. But this was really George's brainchild. And I feel like I'm very fortunate because I'm just the steward of George and, you know, his vision.
all things in right timing. It sounded like George had been thinking about this for a while, having that rapid kind of remark response for when you brought up that question. He knew it was on his mind. He knew exactly, this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
That is a beautiful story of how his brainchild and your ingenuity brought that together. And as intriguing as the name Colossal is, how would you describe what Colossal does to everyone listening here today?
So Colossal is the world's first de-extinction and species preservation company. And we believe those go hand in hand. Like, lots of people just want to write. So we have three big flagship projects that most people know us for, which is the woolly mammoth, the Tasmanian tiger, and the dodo. But with that said, you know, we're also doing a lot in species preservation. And that's really important because it's forecasted that we're going to lose up to 50% of biodiversity between now and 2050 if we don't do anything about it. And what's terrifying about that is when we started the business, it was forecasted to be 15%. So going from 1.5 to 5.0 in a 3-year time period is pretty terrifying. And all the tech that Colossal makes on this kind of path to de-extinction, we make available to the world for free for conservation. And so think of us as kind of this, like, you know, while we're pursuing this moonshot of de-extinction, we're also like this outsourced R&D shop for free for conservation. So anybody can use our technologies to help save species. I'm proud to say that now we have about 48 conservation partners around the world actively using various parts of our de-extinction toolkit.
That is fantastic. And it's so amazing. Honestly, the community of science, when they come together, especially with Colossal, being like, no, we're going to make this completely available for everyone to use. And honestly, I feel like that's how progression happens. You have to just have a free flow of this information.
Yeah.
So you've walked us through the driver, the conversations, what you guys are doing now. But with these topics, how do you balance that focus between bringing back extinct species and preserving currently endangered ones?
Yeah, it's a great question. Fortunately, a lot of the problem sets go hand in hand. So an example of that is the closest living relative to the woolly mammoth is the Asian elephant. It's about 99.6% the same genetically. It's actually closer to Asian elephants than Asian elephants are even to African elephants. And that's always kind of like a mind-blowing fact for people. And what's interesting about that is that 20% of elephants every year, specifically Asian elephants, die from this terrible disease called EEHV. It's a herpes virus that kills basically baby elephants at the time of weaning. It's awful. And so for us, you know, it makes sense for us to ensure that our mammoths and our engineered mammoths don't get that disease, right? And so it's in our best interest as a company to help solve that disease. Well, guess what? That also has this halo effect of, if we solve this disease, we can make that available to the entire world. And just that vaccine alone can save more elephants than all of elephant conservation for the last 100 years, which is amazing when you think about it. And I'm proud to say that Colossal, plus our partners with Dr. Paul Ling at the Baylor College of Medicine, we now actually have vaccines in elephants, and it is conferring resistance to the most deadly strain of EEHV. So that's just kind of one example of like how they go hand in hand. But we felt like some of the early wins of how they go hand in hand weren't enough. So we actually started also the Colossal Foundation. So while Colossal's raised $435 million for our business, we started a nonprofit and we've raised $50 million for the Colossal Foundation, which is just helping to empower people and support new technology development for conservation specifically. And that's all open sourced again to the world.
That is so incredible to hear. And so many questions just pronging off my head as you were mentioning all of these sort of innovations that you guys are deeply ingrained in with the foundation, with the elephant herpes vaccine.
Yeah.
One of the key things you mentioned with regard to the elephants and the separation regarding Asian elephants and African elephants and their relation to mammoths, and how you hope that introducing this vaccine will then prevent that disease from being introduced into the potentially de-extincted mammoth populations. But elephants in general are keystone species. So what role do you see that playing on the wider scope of things when mammoths, for example, and the de-extinction of mammoths could play in restoring damaged ecosystems? And on the inverse, what are the potential ecological impacts of reintroducing an extinct species? Almost feels like a borderline what we kind of knew as science fiction, but it's really been brought to light through this fantastic, incredible work.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's a great question. And so people, when they think of rewilding, they typically just think, oh, you have animals, in most cases, non-extinct animals, right? Because no one's done that before. And they take animals and they put them back into the wild, and people just think that's how it works. But it's actually a very thoughtful, stage-gated process, right? And so people sometimes get worried about the intended but versus the unintended consequences. And so one of the things that I think the rewilding community hasn't done the best job of is educating the public that it's a very stage. So, for example, Tasmanian devils without the facial tumor disease are being reintroduced into mainland Australia from Tasmania. 2 years ago, I was fortunate enough to rewild Ned. Ned was the 21st Tasmanian devil. So even though they're not extinct, they're not like driving thousands of them into the wild overnight, right? So it's a process where they're in a managed care environment. They then go to a bigger environment, a bigger environment, a bigger environment, and then eventually into the wild, right? And so it's a very, people, including conservationists, ecologists, indigenous people groups, local universities, governments, all these people are involved.
It's so deeply entwined. It's a really thought out process.
It's a very thought out process. So we don't have Tasmanian. I'll get back to mammoths here in a second on the ecological impact, but and ecological impacts of elephants. But what's crazy is that, like, while we don't have Tasmanian tigers or thylacines, we have a huge, like, if you go to, not to give anyone homework, but if you go to colossal.com/Tasmania, we have a huge Tasmanian tiger working group. We meet with them every quarter. And it includes people from, the indigenous people groups, private landowners, the former premier. It's got people from the university. It's got people from Tourism Tasmania. It's even got people from the logging industry, because if the logging industry is the largest economic driver in Tasmania. So if you think you're going to go work in the forest without, someone that has, some lobbying ability and some economic driver of that and providing jobs to people in Tasmania, that's kind of a naive perspective. So even though we are, 10 years out from having thylacines ready to rewild them back into the wild, we're working with those people now every single quarter, because it needs to be a very stage-gated process. So there's a lot of research that goes into it. It's not just this,
I love that you have sat down and honestly with your teams thought about what are all of these areas that are going to be impacted by looking at this species and wanting to bring this back, and let's just bring them all on board and get these open discussions running. And it's amazing to hear. On that note, we're going to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be right back after this short break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Ben Lamb, the CEO of Colossal. We just left off on talking about the integration of all multiple indigenous communities, conservationists, organizations working towards habitat restoration, ideas in ecology, and really utilizing all these vast areas of knowledge when it comes to species reintroduction, in particular those that have been extinct. So Ben, I just want to hand the microphone back to you for you to jump us back into that conversation.
Yeah, and so specifically with mammoths, right, what we know about elephants is they're massive, like, environmental modifiers. And there's been some really interesting studies that have come out in Gabon and other places in Africa around forest elephants, and the fact that they actually knock down trees and they actually clear parts of the forest, but they actually only knock down the trees that are the least carbon efficient. And so it's amazing what nature does in the closed system when all of the keystone predators and the keystone in the mezzanine level animals, as well as the, large keystone herbivores and omnivores are there as well, right? And so it works pretty well.
Like, it's a system of balance.
It's a system of balance, right? And so, like, we've seen this also in Yellowstone, right? When we as humanity in the U.S., where when we, in 1925, we culled all the wolves in Yellowstone. Well, we reintroduced the wolves in 1995, only about, I think it was only like 15 or 20 of them back into the park. And literally within like 3 or 4 years, there were beavers there again. The shapes of the rivers changed because of the reintroduction of beavers. There was actually new fish because the ponds and the rivers were actually deeper. And all that became because the wolves forced the elk to start migrating again because the elks got, they overpopulated, they overgrazed, they ate too much around the riverbanks. And so when they did that, that made the beavers not be able to actually build.
It's like a ripple or domino effect.
Crazy domino effect, right? Uh-huh. And so we know that rewilding works when it's gone through this thoughtful process. And the tundra, specifically not just the Arctic Circle, but what's called Circle Polar North, which is even a little bit wider than the typical tundra from a latitude perspective, is actually, it's pretty degraded. There's not a lot of life there. There's a lot of permafrost there. And so they've different people all over the world have started to do different experiments with cold tolerant megafauna to see how it could impact the environment if you remove some of those carnivorous trees and you reintroduce large keystone species. And so now here's where the debate goes in, right? And I'll be the first to say I'm not a scientist. And so we even have people within Colossal, you know, we've got 95 scientific advisors from the top people in the world, like Beth Shapiro and Lou Vidalin and George Church, and Chris Mason. But what's interesting is that, you know, some of them fall in the category that it's going to be massively impactful, that's going to be top down and it's going to drive colder temperatures by packing the snow and revitalizing the Arctic grasslands, right? Some of the other people say, well, we think it's a more bottom-up ecosystem, and we don't think it's going to have that same level of carbon impact. But here's what we know. We know what's been interesting for me, not being a scientist, is bringing these interesting, smart people all together that have different views on this, right? And saying, look, where do you guys meet? And what I found about this is that they all agree that elephants in general are incredible carbon sinks, and that large herbivores through the nitrogen oxygen cycle of eating and defecation and migratory patterns improve the ecosystem. So what we do know is, even though we can't measure the exact impact yet, and there's different models in terms, like some people can tell you it'll store this much carbon and it'll make this level of impact on methane. And some say they think it'll be this level, and those are vastly different numbers. What they all agree on is that a more biodiverse ecosystem with these keystone species is a healthier ecosystem where more animals and plants flourish. And so we don't know the exact impact, but everyone generally believes it'll be a net positive to the ecosystem.
Sounds like Colossal has put together the perfect Venn diagram of scientists within its company. You've got the perfect cross section in the middle where they're all just like, this is all what we agree on. But what's great about the other two is that it then challenges their way of thinking and how they approach the science. I just want to jump back to something that you mentioned earlier, which was the Colossal Foundation. And I'd love to talk through about how Colossal is contributing to the conservation of endangered species like the vaquita and others.
Yeah. So what we wanted to do is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we're working on these projects like EEHV that tie directly. So every single de-extinction project within Colossal, we try to pair it with a critically endangered species, right? So for example, with the mammoth, that's obviously the Asian elephant because it's a direct one-to-one. So we're also editing. With the dodo, it's the pink pigeon in Mauritius, because spoiler alert, dodos were pigeons. And then with the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger, it's the northern quoll, right? So we're actually engineering in cane toad toxin resistance because cane toads have been introduced into northern Australia, and they're an invasive species that, you know, a lot of these carnivorous marsupials love to eat, but then it kills them with cane toxins, right? And so these neurotoxins. So we've actually been engineering in resistance to them and doing some tests around that. We've been able to say that what's been interesting is one single nucleotide change confers a 5,000 times resistance. And we did that by studying the mammals and even the snakes that aren't obviously not mammals in South America that co-evolved next to cane toads. And given enough time, those marsupials in northern Australia would actually, you know, probably evolve cane toad toxin resistance. They didn't co-evolve for millions of years, so they'll probably be extinct before that happens. So we're trying to help it with a little bit of accelerated evolution, right? And so that's all the stuff we're doing with Colossal. But then because of those successes that we've seen, we went and raised this $50 million separate money in this Colossal Foundation. And, you know, unlike a lot of foundations, we don't have to have big black tide dinners and big $10,000 plate fundraisers. You know, our investors were really happy to support the efforts here. And then what we're doing is we put up a couple of big flagship projects. So Colossal will fund anybody that is developing new technologies for conservation and giving them to the world for free. So we're doing some really cool avian work in Australia. We're doing some stuff around chytrid, which is the leading cause killer of and driving extinction across, you know, all amphibians, which is terrible. We're doing some artificial womb work with George Church in his lab. So doing all that kind of stuff. But then to your point about the vaquita, we actually announced three flagship projects. Not that we're doing, but we thought that model was good. Like, let's give the community something to shoot for under which we will fund.
And on this topic of community and scientific development, how is Colossal, as well as the foundation, collaborating with traditional conservation organizations? We recently had Save the Elephants on with Frank, yeah, talking about your assistant with elephant behavior tracking. But yeah, I know that's just a small fraction of the wider work.
Yeah, so we were doing some of that stuff at Colossal, and then we're like, well, we should just do this at the foundation. And so, like, the work we're doing with, we're doing great work with understanding using cameras and drones and AI models for elephant havens in Botswana to understand rewilding and herd dynamics and how you reintroduce orphan elephants back into herds, right? We're also working with Frank and his team. They're amazing. And then the whole team there are just the best on migratory patterns and social cues and how we identify individual elephants from the sky. So we're doing all of that with Save the Elephants. We are the genetic rescue partner for Dr. Thomas Hildebrandt and the biorescue team on the northern white rhino. So we're actually looking at how do we engineer in genetic diversity and do genetic population mapping, because there's only two females left. So how do we take all of that data from museums and engineer it in so that we actually have multiple founder lines through synthetic biology? And then you know, that all leads to, all that work led to us doing the foundation and putting these big moonshots like the vaquita. And so now we, Colossal won't save the vaquita, but hopefully Colossal Foundation will be the hub that brings all these people together, and we fund numerous groups. So we're working with like an acoustic monitoring group in Mexico that's looking at just how do we help identify where all the vaquita are. We're working with a biobanking group that wants to actually biobank the remaining ones. And then we'll have a cell culture group. So we try to bring these people together and use our funding and some of our innovative ideas. And kind of like Google did in the early days, we allow our staff to use a percentage of their time to help the foundation and help those projects.
That is so beautiful. It's deeply integrated into the systems of workflow, both for the people and the organization as a whole. You mentioned there your work with various research institutions. Could you talk us through a bit about the collaborations and partnerships that Colossal has developed?
Oh, it's critical, right? So for example, and it also goes kind of hand in hand with the comment you mentioned earlier. So one of the things I think we've done the best is be pretty open, pretty collaborative. And we actually have a history of running towards critics, which is not typical. Most people are like, we hate our critics. We want to run away from
our critics. That's how you learn. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Challenge it head on. Yeah. We're a lot more from an informed critic than someone that just says, hell yeah, we should do this, right? You just do. I mean, we
science don't. Science is about being challenged.
Love, hell yeah, you should do this, people. We do. We do. So I don't want to say we don't love those people. We're not asking for more critics. But
you need your supporters. You need your support, but you need your critics too.
The critics are great. And so, like, Beth Shapiro, our chief science officer, who came from the University of Santa Cruz, she's the number one person in the world in ancient DNA and had the largest ancient DNA lab here in the
U.S.
She's
incredible.
Yeah, she's amazing. And so she left academia for us. She was one of our biggest critics when we launched. And so we now have a relationship now, which is Beth, but also with the University of Santa Cruz. We work with 17 universities around the world. Our largest supplier of mammoth genomes, we have now over 70 mammoth genomes. Those came from Luva Dahlén at the University of Stockholm. Luva is the number one expert in the world in mammoths. And so, you know, when we came out, he was pretty negative on us. And what we did is we picked up the phone and called him. And I think he was a little shocked and taken back. He's like, I just talked so much shit about these guys. Why are they calling us? And the reason we called them was because, you know, regardless of what he was saying and whether he liked us or not, he's the number one guy in the world in mammoths. So we would be naive not to at least listen to his feedback. Doesn't mean we have to agree with all of it. But what's been interesting with these universities is that as we've collaborated with them, some of those have turned into advisor roles. Some of those have turned into friendships. Some of those have turned into full-on funding. And so we actually fund 17 universities around the world. 40 postdocs in academic labs work every day because we are paying for their postdocs. And I love that, right? Because we're furthering science and we're also trying to bring in the kind of the minds of tomorrow.
Mm. And they're not tied into work for Colossal after that point, correct? Or is it just
fully funded? Some of them choose to come work with us, right?
Absolutely. You're doing amazing work. Why wouldn't they? But they're not tied in by the benefit of having that support.
There's no requirement. We just support it. Now, we do get the benefit, and so does our foundation. Some of them are funded through Colossal. Some of them are funded. Some of them that are IP related get funded through Colossal. Those that aren't get funded through the foundation. But, you know, there's no requirements post their postdoc.
No, I honestly love that. It's grassroots science. It's really what it is. Like, hey, I've got this idea. I've got this theory. I want to test it out. And you guys are here. Be like, you know what? We believe in that. We're going to support that. We're going to try and get that through to an answer. We've spoken a lot here about the developing technologies that Colossal has been working on, especially to combat diseases affecting endangered species. I kind of wanted to carry that forward and look at the dramatic progression of artificial intelligence. How is Colossal, is it, or could it be utilizing AI and machine learning and genetic research and your de-extinction efforts?
Yeah, it wouldn't. We would not be where we are today, and we would not be where we're going to be in the next 5 years without AI and compute. You know, we actually spun out the first thing we built at Colossal was a software platform. You know, I mostly come from software. So when you have software, and some of my other early partners and co-founders, we're all from software, right? And so everything looks like a software nail when you have a bunch of software hammers laying around, right? So the first thing we did, knowing that we have to do ancient DNA assembly and we have to do comparative genomics to the closest living relative in these species, there's a lot of computational work. And the better that we can get at that and not have to do that manually, both through compute, machine learning, and different AI models has been key.
I had to do so much statistics when I was doing my biology degree.
Oh, yeah.
It's
changed. Look, I love large language models. I love where, like, you know, Grok and these other systems are going. Like, they're awesome. Like, they're super great. And I think they'll advance humanity in a lot of different ways. There's not enough, personally, in my view, dedicated yet to life sciences. The very limited work, I shouldn't say limited, but limited compared to some of the natural language processing and
language
work on the same scale. Like if you look at like DeepMind and some of the stuff that's come, you know, from Google, there's been some great stuff, right? In a very short period of time. And so I do think that biology and healthcare will probably be one of the biggest benefits to, as well as coding, will be some of the kind of the biggest benefits from AI. And I think we're just starting to see that ramp. Like I think OpenAI just announced some stuff around longevity and whatnot. And so I really believe that. So for us, we built all this internally, right? So we built everything kind of internally that we use. We do use some of the third party protein folding and protein engineering models out there because they've just, you know, people have spent billions of dollars on them. So we do utilize them. But a lot of the stuff we do internally, like we even have a system that we've been training that there's different to figure out what the best vector designs are and the best delivery designs are for our various editing modalities. We actually have a system that's like a recommendation engine. So we now, and we've been just giving it this feedback loop based on different species, both avian and mammalian. And so it's actually pretty good. And so it's actually now recommending.
It sounds ingenious to me. I'm just thinking of adding this prompt and being like, I've got this. Tell me what to do now. And it's like, use this.
Yeah. And so it's we've trained this local model that's working pretty well, right? Because we are doing thousands of edits. We're screening. We're doing monoclonal screening on thousands of cells every week. We're now just implementing a lot of robotic process automation and computer vision into that process right now. But all of that, you know, feeds back into a couple of these core models. And so our next big project that we're working on in partnership with FormBio, which is the software business we spun out of Colossal, is something called Species Flow. So we're actually now expanding on that tool set to the different stages of cellular health, media development and whatnot. And so we're going to be tracking all of those things and trying to build unique bespoke models for each one of these kind of micro steps that then will feed into a macro progression. So then we can surface and have a better understanding where we have different kind of stage gate issues.
Fantastic. We went through a lot of vector deliveries and cell biology and the amount of incredible research that's going on internally inside Colossal. How do you think advances in synthetic biology are impacting your work, especially in the upcoming years?
You know, there's been some bottlenecks around, and so we're doing synthetic biology. I would argue that Colossal is probably the most advanced synthetic biology company in the world because we, at our core, we're not trying to clone these species, right? We're trying to identify the genes that made a mammoth and engineered into Asian elephants. And sometimes that opens the door to so many philosophical debates. Like the biggest debate we ever have now, there was all kinds of debates in the early days. Like, they don't have enough money. It's super hard. The technologies aren't there. They don't have the people. So we don't have labs. So we've solved all the feedback out there, right? That has been negative. The only one that we will never solve is some people have a different perspective on de-extinction, right?
We think yes. Ethical considerations, insanely crucial.
Think of de-extinction as functional de-extinction. Like, what can you actually do and what purpose is it solving? And so we think of de-extinction as functional de-extinction. And then at the same time, we also think about functional de-extinction as really rebuilding extinct species to today. And so we're actually synthesizing, in some cases, we're actually synthesizing large pieces of DNA and swapping it in, right? And some of that is also including engineering new things like resilience to EEHV. And so what's interesting about that is we as humanity is not yet to the point that we can like print a whole chromosome. If we could do that, that'd make our lives super easy because then we could just use microinduction and be done. So we've kind of done a dual path, right? Where we've done these single edits. We've really been probably the most advanced company, if not research lab in the world, on multiplex editing, editing multiple parts of the genome at the same time. And then we've also been working on DNA synthesis, right? And so how do we synthesize, you know, synthetically big pieces of DNA and swap it in? And, you know, we've done over 100 KB, and the largest thing that we've seen out there from a published perspective is about 30, 35, it's either 30 or 35. So we know that we are on at least...
The key term is published on that end, so there still could be some research that's ongoing publicly available.
And if anybody's done that super secretly, they should call us because we'd love to do it.
One of our listeners is going to call them, well, actually, the 200.
Yeah, we've done 1 megabyte in what? That'd be great. We'd love to honor you or talk to you or invest in you or collaborate.
You had it hit fast.
Yeah. So it's cool. So I think that synthetic biology, you know, I take a step back and I think that kind of like CRISPR became the catch-all for genome engineering, which we know, you and I know it isn't, but it became synonymous with that. I think synthetic biology is going to be more synonymous with gene-directed, intentionally genetically modified organisms, as well as, you know, fully engineered or partially engineered organisms, and in even directed evolution. I think that synthetic biology over time becomes a catch-all for all of that. And what's crazy to me is that we have not opened the door. We are like at the barely open sliver of the door of synthetic biology. And I truly believe with AI and compute, synthetic biology will have potentially the biggest impact that humanity has ever known.
Incredible. And I definitely believe that in the sense that I feel like with science, we're always like, oh, we've learned all this new information. It turns out we knew nothing. And that happens every year. Every year, we're just like, oh, no, we've learned nothing.
Every year, we're like, huh.
I kind of wanted to trace it back to the ethical considerations that we kind of just alluded to quickly there. I wanted to know how Colossal is approaching ethical implications of de-extinction and genetic engineering. Now, I know that it's been highly involved in science over the past decade, and it's only going to progress as we continue, particularly down this path, particularly with Colossal's targets of what they want to achieve internationally and within the work that they want to complete. But these questions will always arise, and these will be deeply embedded public questions as well.
Yeah, you know, we're not going to get everything right. I think our approach is trying to be as inclusive with university partners, indigenous people groups, governments, and you know, even bioethicists, right? So kind of in that same vein of you know, running towards critics. Before we launched the company, we identified a woman named Alta Charo. She's our lead bioethicist. She's incredible. I love her dearly. She's helped me many, many sleepless nights.
Her talks are amazing. Yeah, if you get a chance to listen to some of her talks.
She's the best. But she debated George Church years before we started the business on why you should never bring back a mammoth. And this may sound crazy, but I was like, she's the one. We need her.
It sounds right to me.
not about persuasion, it's about education, right? And so I want to, the reality is these tools, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. These tools exist. Someone's going to do things like this. How do we do this in a way that's ethical and transformative and inspiring for the world? You know, we talked about the impacts, we talked about the monetization, but it's also inspiring. Where I'm in my home office, I don't have anything here, but if we're at my office, we literally get like every week, kids send us little pictures of mammoths, or moms write us a note saying, thank you for what you're doing. We're so inspired by this. My kid drew this dodo for you guys. We were going to actually start posting them online, we decided, because it's incredible. And it's like on our worst day here, that's happening. And so we're going to make mistakes. But I think the approach that we take is to be really collaborative with all these different people and try to learn along the way. And, you know, that's why we went to Alta Churro. I was like, look, someone's going to do stuff like this. We think that we can do it the most transparent, ethical way and also push these technologies forward for humanity and for conservation as well as human healthcare. We also think we can inspire the next generation. And, you know, for as many critics as we have, it's working. Like people every day are sending us, you know, amazing things about their kids. Or we now even get stuff where it's like, my teacher is making us. I love that. These are the older kids that are not drawing us crayon drawings anymore. My teacher is making us do a paper on you guys. Can I interview one of your scientists? I mean, we get that request weekly.
You should just have one person that does all the kid interviews. That's your job. Do all the interviews with the kids.
I've not been making Sarah Ord do it, but our Ord who runs our thylacine project, she's great. And she's very, very personable. And she's also insanely busy.
You're just making her schedule worse. You're like, actually, I want you to talk to all these kids.
No, but, you know, she's a young, really smart female scientist, you know.
And I love that. Women in STEM, get them forward. Get more girls
Our thylacine lead, our dodo lead, and our chief scientists are all women. And so I think it's really inspiring when they go talk to them. And so, you know, I think that the younger generation can really relate to not just the work that we're doing, the impact that we're having, but also people like Sarah. And so so she does a lot of them. But she also loves doing them, so I don't feel really that bad making her do them. I don't make them. I ask her. I ask who wants to do them, and she always volunteers. So I think it's Darwin.
Oh, that is lovely. On that note, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hey, welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here speaking with Ben Lam, the CEO of Colossal. So far, me and Ben have been on an amazing journey of conversations from the foundations of where Colossal began to Colossal Foundation and the amazing work that they're doing and how they're now inspiring future generations, allowing them to have conversations with some of their scientists. I want to jump back in to what we just left off on, which was the ideas about ethical considerations when it comes to de-extinction and particularly genetic engineering when it comes to conservation and the future of science. What I would love to think about here is, despite all these challenges when it comes to that, what do you think are common misconceptions that people have about de-extinction and genetic engineering? And how do you think we can better educate the public? Because often than not, the questions are coming from a lack of educational understanding around the topic.
Yeah, I think that's where, you know, George Church's wife, Ting, is actually doing a lot of great work at Harvard about this. She's actually trying to educate people on that, like things like GMOs aren't bad, right? And you're always going to have bad actors. You're always going to have people doing weird stuff with these tools, right? We've all seen people start to, in China and other places, start to look at applying these tools to humans and whatnot. And that needs to be a very in germline editing. That's stuff that needs to be very, very thoughtfully managed, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that if we can, and like I said, we're gonna mess things up. You know, we're gonna make people mad. We're gonna do things that we thought were all the right things, and we're gonna get feedback. And I think that our kind of cultural zeitgeist internally is one of taking feedback and collaboration. But I think the ethical challenges are hard, right? And, you know, I think that we are trying to navigate them at Colossal the best we can with, you know, conservation groups and bioethicists and even governments that we work with and collaborate with. But, you know, even with the best intentions, we're gonna do things wrong. You know, there's other companies out there that'll probably do similar things that we're doing. They may not do them the same way that we're doing.
I don't necessarily say it's about perfection, though.
I think it's about a conversation. I don't think it's about perfection at all. I think it's a conversation. I think we've already done things wrong. Like, you kind of applauded me earlier in the call about how we're working in Tasmania now with this stuff. Well, just full disclosure, that wasn't our idea. Like, you know, I was on a call and I was getting slammed by some reporter, and the reporter's like, "Have you even been to Tasmania? Have you even been to Alaska?" And I was like, "Nope."
Really, this is a perfect example of learning through your critics.
It was a really good point. And I was like, "Yep." And within a month, I was meeting with all the right people in Tasmania, and literally came back from that trip 3 weeks later, went and did the same thing and did open forums with indigenous people groups in some of the native tribes in Alaska. And so, but it was a really good point. They're like, "How do you know they really feel this way?" I was like, "You know, we don't. We think we do."
This is exactly how you learn, and your intention afterward speaks for, oh, I don't know the word I'm looking for here. It just speaks to itself in the sense that you put together all of this incredible work based off the fact that you were like, okay, we thought this way, but you were proven wrong. We're going to now be counteractive and be productive in the way that we move forward.
Yeah, we were respectfully challenged. I don't even know how respectful it was. We were challenged, and they had a really good point, right? And so, look, we do get... I don't want to make us look all too altruistic, because we do get frustrated with some critics' feedback that isn't informed, right? I think the key word for us is informed critics, right? Sometimes, like, we get feedback from people that don't have a background in genetics, but like the press wants a negative, wants a counterbalance. So they'll go to some person that hates us, and that person will have like a background in, like, you know, not cellular biology, not conservation. Now, and I often like to not respectfully challenge them. It's like, well, how much time have you spent in Africa with elephants? How much time have you spent on elephant conservation? How much money have you given to any of these? And typically those answers are zero, right? And so I get that everyone wants to have an opinion, but I think that, you know, we've done a good job of filtering out the informed critics from the uninformed critics. And we're always going to have those people. The same, like, five people show up in every negative perspective on us. And
there they are, once again.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, you know, like, look, we know he or she hates us. We could have just given you the same soundbite they give on every interview. It would make your life easier.
It could just be a pre-record, you know, they'll just press play. Yeah.
We could make life easier on you and them. But sometimes I think that's lazy journalism, right? And so it's like, when you're asking someone that's got like an art degree on their belief on our genetic engineering capabilities.
Oh, let's not get down the rabbit hole of media now. Come on, we can end up.
I think it's important that media, especially now more than ever, has a balanced perspective. But the problem is, some of these projects are hard and nuanced. And this kind of ties back into the ethics, right?
No, this is what I meant. We would end up down a rabbit hole because I could talk about this for ages.
You want to have a public dialogue.
Yeah.
The dialogue has to trust the system that's providing the public the data, right? And so, you know, and so we also give feedback to all kinds of people, including different journalists on, you know, we've actually recommended informed critics that have really good views that are negative towards us. And once again, that's not typical. Most companies, I don't think, would do that. But we're like, hey, here's a list of people that don't philosophically agree with us, and they have very valid points, but they're also the tops of their field. And so we try to, this all goes back to your ethics question, which is, it's about a conversation. We're not going to do everything right. We're going to try to rapidly iterate and pivot based on the feedback that we get and what we learn over time. But, you know, this is a series of technologies that now are available to the world, and people are going to do different things with them.
That is very true. I'm so happy that you brought up that topic of media. It's honestly what instigated me to start Our Altered World. I was getting really tired of negative climate rhetoric, and I wanted to combat that and really showcase the amazing work that's going on.
Like, look, I understand. I think it's great that the media, the general purpose media, has made the world know there's a thing that we are affecting the climate, right? Because for a long time, you know, it was just people like Al Gore running around. And now generally people understand that we as humanity are affecting it. So I think that's a good thing. What I don't see enough of is hope. There's been studies that have come out even in the last month that says that younger generations are becoming less hopeful because all they're hearing is negative stuff. And what we think about is today, as we think about like issues in the Middle East, sadly, there's been issues in the Middle East for a long time. We think about the Ukraine and Russia conflict and war. Guess what? There's been wars for a long time. Our grandparents were in wars. Our great grandparents fought in wars, right? And so, like, I'm not saying that that's a good thing, but there's always been problems. And I read this really sad report like 2 weeks ago where it was talking about how there's not enough hope being instilled in kids now. Because even back then, there was hope being instilled. And right now, it's just so much doom and gloom. You know, if you think that you're fighting an unwinnable war with climate, then people are just going to move on to the next topic. And that's not what we need. We need 1,000 colossals out there, not one. We need 1,000 companies doing things to save biodiversity.
There are many companies around the world doing incredible work. I've had so many of them on the show so far. And on that note of positivity, despite all of these challenges that we've kind of mentioned here, what are some of the reasons to be optimistic about the future of de-extinction and conservation genetics?
I think that if we can, I just spoke at Davos at the World Economic Forum, and they were very excited to hear about the need for biobanking of critical keystone species and endangered species. My hope would be that, you know, we would just change all consumer behavior and we don't lose species. That's probably not realistic. But what's great about synthetic biology and even a kind of more advanced technologies like artificial blooms, which we're also working on, I think we'll get to a point where we have an end-to-end de-extinction toolkit that any, you know, government or any conservation partner can use to save species. And if we have that, and we also have, we start our accelerated biobanking now in a distributed way with collaborations of lots of countries and the United Nations, well, then I think that we'll be in a place that we can, you know, while consumer behavior starts to shift and change, I think that we will at least be in a place that, you know, we can bring back lost recent keystone species. And so I really believe that we are at the cusp of those engineering breakthroughs.
Oh, how incredible would that be? We have spoken through all of the fantastic projects that Colossal has been involved with internationally. Can you elaborate maybe on some of your biggest achievements over these recent years?
Yeah, you know, I think that some of our biggest achievements that we've talked about publicly is we've completed the most complete genome of an ancient genome ever, being the thylacine. It's over 99.9% complete. Many people said that we wouldn't even be able to achieve that, and we did. We've actually edited over 300 edits into a mammalian cell, which has never been done, that are nonlinear repeats, meaning they're all over the genome. We've been able to deliver 25 to 30 plus edits at a time with 90% plus efficiency, which no one has ever done. We've created induced pluripotent stem cells in numerous species, including elephants, which people worked on for years. We now have vaccine and EHV in trials. So I feel like we're not quite there on the primordial germ cells for pigeons, for dodos, but I think we're pretty close. I think we'll get there in the next 6 months. And so, yeah, I mean, what's great is two of our three flagship projects are in the editing phase. We are editing right now Asian elephant cells with mammoth alleles, and we're editing right now fat-tailed Dunard cells with thylacine alleles. So, I mean, that's a testimony in itself that like
milestone
editing phase.
Amazing. Ben, I kind of want to just wrap things up by going through maybe what the most important thing you want listeners to take away from our chat here, and what kind of message of hope and encouragement would you like to share with listeners today?
Yeah. Biodiversity is a real problem. It's a problem that on the scale of climate change, not enough people are talking about it. But one of the beautiful things about biodiversity, at least here in the States, is that both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and Democrats, agree that losing animals is bad. and losing biodiversity is bad. And so I believe that synthetic biology is our biggest hope, and biobanking and building bio vaults are our biggest hope. And I think the market success that we've had with capital raising and support for our foundation shows that there's lots of people out there that care. And, you know, the best thing that people can do is intern for us, talk to us, ask us questions, help us, criticize us, help us do better. But yeah, I'm very hopeful of the future with these technologies for biodiversity.
Just quickly, could you tell our listeners where they can learn more about Colossal and how they can potentially get involved?
Yeah, so we're on all social channels. We're at Colossal on X. We're pretty active on X. And then obviously colossal.com is our core website.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Ben. And thank you so much for sitting down with me today. And I want to thank you all for listening to Our Altered World. If you enjoy the show, I'd love for you to visit ouralteredworld.com, where you can join our community and find out more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at Flunking Monkey, FlunkingMonkey. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.